I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and you probably know by now that I'm entering my last 2 weeks on the air before retiring. Gretchen and Colleen have assembled favorite guests and subjects, and as you might gather, Abraham Lincoln is on the schedule today, actually. I grew up in Illinois and visited Springfield and New Salem when I was in middle school and was captivated even then by the life of Abraham Lincoln, and it's been a lifelong interest. Some of you went on our WPR journey to Springfield. We took two trips there, actually, and they were just moved the souls. All of us who went on those trips just were moved beyond measure by what we saw. And also, some of you were on the trip to Gettysburg and Washington, D.C., and those were marvelous journeys as well. We've done quite a few shows on our 16th president because I think he is worth it. He's worth studying. And so today, as we start wrapping up broadcasts, our guest this hour is a Lincoln scholar. Dr. Alan Gulzo came to Lincoln when he was 6 or 7 through a Classics Illustrated comic book. We'll have to hear about that. He's professor of the Civil War era and director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. He's the author of a number of books, and we've interviewed him about a couple of these. Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America, Abraham Lincoln is a Man of Ideas, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, and we are delighted to welcome him again to the program. And welcome your phone calls, too. I'm particularly interested in hearing from some of you as I do some reminiscing the next week and a half about journeys that we took. Those of you who are on either of our Springfield trips, I'd love to hear from you this hour, or that wonderful trip we took to Gettysburg and to Washington, D.C., where, of course, Lincoln remains omnipresent. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Gulzo, hello. Thanks for being with us again. Hi.
Well, hello again, and it's very nice to be with you there.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So I heard you in some little clip I was watching yesterday that you came to Lincoln through some kind of comic book series. Is that true?
Yes, it was a Classics Illustrated. I still have the comic book.
No.
Yes, I do. It was a Classics Illustrated, one of that very unusual, maybe we could call it kind of highbrow comic books, or at least it was an effort to try to make comic books highbrow back in the 1950s. But I came upon this at the newsstand in a railway station. My grandmother and I were taking a rail trip from Philadelphia to Chicago, and I pointed the finger at that. She bought it for me. And you might say, ever since then, it's been history.
It sure has been. It's been a lot of history for you. There's something, I think when I was very young, what captivated me about him is that he was such a smart man, and he did it almost all by himself. He did all this reading and thinking and all of that because he didn't go to school for very long at all.
No, he probably attended formal schooling for something less than a calendar year's worth. It was broken in pieces. On the other hand, don't jump too quickly to conclusions, because a lot of people in his day probably had nothing more than that in the way of schooling either. What was remarkable was that his father was willing to pay for him to have even that much. Mm-hmm. Schooling like that was expensive on the Indiana frontier. There were no public school systems, so any schooling that you wanted a child to enjoy was going to have to be paid for from your own pocket. And that was for a farmer in southern Indiana in the 1820s. That was a very dear proposition.
Yes. His family, I have read, his father particularly, one of the reasons they moved to Illinois was they were happy it was an anti-slavery state. There was no love for slavery in the Lincoln family, was there?
Oh, no, no. All the indications are that from the very beginning, Lincoln grew up in an environment which was antithetical to slavery. Now, you have to hedge that, because there were many people who disliked slavery, but they also disliked black people at the same time, and sometimes it was very difficult to disentangle the two. What many people who opposed slavery didn't want was economic competition with African Americans, And so they opposed slavery, not necessarily because they didn't think that slavery was a good thing in an egalitarian society, but because they just didn't want slave labor around at all, and especially they didn't want black slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to parse what the Lincolns as a family might have thought in the 1820s on this particular subject, but at least they were, to that extent, on the side of the angels by definitely opposing slavery. They belonged to a religious denomination that was hostile to slavery. And Lincoln himself talked about how his father had decided to move from Kentucky to Indiana, partly on account of slavery. Now, partly also on account of defects in land titles, so there's a little element of selfishness there.
Right.
But slavery certainly was something that the Lincolns were not friendly to. And Lincoln says that he had always hated slavery, that he couldn't remember a time when he didn't hate slavery and regard it as a matter of injustice. So that he breathes right in with the rest of the atmosphere of childhood from the Lincoln family.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading, it's not yours, but when I retire next week, I'm going to start reading even more books on Abraham Lincoln. I was reading one on vacation last week and was very interested to read about Stephen Douglas and the speeches he was giving in Chicago. I'm from Illinois, so I was thinking that probably Illinois in the 1830s had a very different complexion if you were in the northern part of the state or the southern part of the state, because more Southerners may have landed more pro-slavery people in southern Illinois, whereas Stephen Douglas, in giving a speech, a pro-slavery speech in Chicago, was booed royally by thousands and thousands of people at the point he had to leave the stage.
Well, this is true, and he's booed there not only because he is going to make comments friendly or at least indifferent to slavery, but also because he will do nothing to stop the spread of slavery into the Western territories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, there's an element of self-interest here, because many of those people in his audience in Chicago who were booing him for the comments that he's going to make about slavery and his indifference to the spread of slavery were also thinking themselves about moving into those Western territories. And they didn't want competition, economically speaking, either, for land in the Western territories. So to a certain degree, yes, he gets what he deserves. But at the same time, the people who were dishing it out probably were not always doing it with entirely pure motives.
What's interesting is this slavery issue stays with Lincoln for a good portion of his life, doesn't it? So it's in the Lincoln-Douglas debates are all about slavery. He comes to national attention because of his comments during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He's president during the Civil War, trying to keep the Union together, but slavery is the big issue of the Civil War. He got the Emancipation Proclamation, and then he essentially loses his life over the issue. It's so central to his whole life, isn't it?
It shows up right away in his political career when he has been elected to the Illinois State Legislature, and there he joins with one other Whig representative in the Illinois Legislature to protest what the Illinois Legislature is doing, passing resolutions, backing up Southern states in their demands for a free hand with slavery, and he denounces this as injustice and bad policy. So right in the 1830s, right from almost from the very beginning of his political career, he is dealing with slavery and the issues around slavery, and they haunt him through all of his life, mm-hmm. something which intensifies in the 1850s, when anyone who really wanted to try to ignore the role that slavery was playing in national politics really couldn't do it anymore. The noise had just become too great, and you couldn't stop up your ears to it anymore, especially after the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And from that point, from 1854, Lincoln emerges as an increasingly primary figure in the opposition to slavery. And in this case, an opposition, and I think this is really significant for Lincoln, it's an opposition which is not based just on self-interested motives. I mean, he'll appeal to self-interest. That's one of his strengths. He knows how to get an audience with him. But he will always, whenever he is making a speech about slavery, always will bring the question back to first principles. Is this right? Is this wrong? And finally, he will say, on the very eve of his presidency, he will say the fundamental thing which divides Northerners and Southerners on this issue, and really it is the only thing that divides them, is. They think it is right and should be condoned. We think it is wrong and should be limited. But, of course, that, putting it in those terms, makes it sound very simple. But that, of course, captured the nub of why the nation was willing to go to war on the subject.
Right. What a time in history. Tell me more about the Whigs. Henry Clay was, I have read, do you agree with this, Lincoln's favorite politician, why Lincoln was a Whig, what happened to the party, what their stand was on slavery.
Henry Clay was Lincoln's beau ideal of a statesman, as he described him. And what a career Henry Clay had had. I mean, he's born during the Revolutionary years in Virginia. He emigrates to Kentucky, and Kentucky becomes Henry Clay land. To a certain extent, Henry Clay is still a major figure in the historical memory of people in Kentucky. Clay was, in many ways, a Southerner. He owned slaves. He had a large plantation in Kentucky called Ashland. But at the same time, he also was very dicey about the overall impact that slavery was having on American life. He had once been a loyal, flag-following Jeffersonian. He had been a heart-and-soul Democrat, had rushed to drag the United States into the War of 1812, and came out of that experience a very chastened politician. He begins raising questions about Jeffersonian political orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And slavery was part of that orthodoxy. He raises questions about its economics. He raises questions about its ethics. And he raises questions about slavery. He never actually emancipates his own slaves. But he does become the president of the American Colonization Society, which was a significant gesture in those days. And he puts the politics of the United States onto a significantly different track than the one that had been promoted by Thomas Jefferson and by Jefferson's great heir, Andrew Jackson. What Henry Clay wants to promote, and these are the 3 points of his so-called American system, he wanted to promote internal improvements,
yes,
we would call it infrastructure, mm-hmm, today. He wanted a national banking system to stabilize the economy, and he wanted protective tariffs to keep out competition from foreign manufacturing and encourage American manufacturing. Well, Lincoln signs on to this from the earliest moments of adult political consciousness, because what Lincoln sees in this is an economic world that encourages people to rise from humble beginnings and transform themselves into something entirely different, entirely more successful, more satisfying, and more prosperous. He really believed that what Henry Clay, and he said this in the funeral eulogy he gave for Henry Clay after Clay's death in 1852, that Henry Clay loved his country, not just because it was his country, but because the United States showed what could happen in a country of free men where people were free to make themselves and become prosperous. Mm. To Lincoln, that stood at 180-degree opposition to ideas of aristocracy and monarchy.
Yes.
He really suspected the Democrats were really just an Americanized version of people who wanted to be a monarchical elite. That's why they called Andrew Jackson King Andrew. So this is why Lincoln finds a political home with Henry Clay and the Whigs. And when the Whig Party dissolves in 1856 over the slavery contention, Lincoln will take most of that into the new Republican Party, which he joins for the first time publicly in 1856.
And all you have to do is you're listening to Henry Clay or looking at Lincoln as he's giving the eulogy is think, well, this guy is certainly a humble guy who made it to the top. You know, all he had to do was stand there and people would think you're a case study in what you're talking about.
Well, this was it. When Lincoln was talking about internal improvements and tariffs, what he's really describing is a route up from poverty to success and prosperity, of which he himself was a living example. When he embraced Henry Clay's ideas and embraced the Whig Party, he wasn't just signing on to a political allegiance. He was really reflecting something that he felt was his real life story. Hmm. So So he looks at the Whig Party and then subsequently the Republican Party, and what he sees is exactly what he has gone through in life. Now, contrast that with the party of slavery. Because in the party of slavery, there is no mobility whatsoever. How could there be?
Right.
When you have a slave labor system, the one thing you don't want your slaves to become are not slaves. That's why you've made them slaves in the first place. You don't want mobility. You don't want a rambunctious middle class, which is trying to climb the ladder of personal success. What you want is stability. You want people fixed in place. And for anyone who happens to be in the middle and who is unhappy with lack of mobility, well, you buy them off with all kinds of subsidies or racial supremacy theories. And Lincoln looked at that and said, that is the end of American independence. That is a betrayal of the most fundamental American principles. So what he sees himself doing is not just endorsing a political program with Clay and the Whigs. What he's really doing is speaking for what he believes is the genius of American democracy.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about the life of Abraham Lincoln this hour of the program because we've done so many shows on Lincoln, and presidential history has been a big part of the interviews that I've done over 24 years here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest is a Lincoln historian. He's written many, many books. We'll talk about the Battle of Gettysburg because he is a professor now of the Civil War era and director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. He is the author of Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which he thought had not been fully studied, so he decided that he would do just that and wrote a book about it. Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America. And we're welcoming phone calls. I think, and you know this because we've done a lot of shows, we've done other presidents, but Lincoln is, I think, the most fascinating and probably effective president that we've ever had. And so much has been written about him, and so we're just adding to the so much that has been said about him. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you if you'd like to join the conversation about Lincoln. Our email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and we'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Professor Carl Gelzo, is with us, and we're talking about Abraham Lincoln this hour of the program. Last week it was Ulysses Grant, so we thought that it would be a good time to talk about Lincoln once again before I leave the airwaves. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If any of you went on our trips, I don't know if any of you are listening to Springfield, we went on two of those, and we also went to Gettysburg and to Washington, D.C. We'd love to hear from you about your memories of those experiences. Frank in Wausau, our first caller for you. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Professor Gelzo. This is really a privilege and an honor to talk to you. I happen to be listening to the Teaching Company lecture series that you did some years ago. Uh-huh. I happen to be listening to it last night, and here you are on the radio.
That's
real
great.
Thrill. But one thing that popped into my head was during Abraham Lincoln's, I don't know if it was a senatorial campaign, but he was criticized for not being a member of a Christian church or not being a member of a church, yet he was able to say that he never was against any of the Christian principles. And the other thing, and then later on with his debates with Stephen Douglas apparently had his religious background on his sleeve, and Abraham Lincoln, who was really not a church member, yet on moral grounds is why he opposed slavery. And what got me thinking about how we as a people sometimes will justify a stand we sort of justify it in our minds because that's the going idea of the times. But could you speak to that, difference between Douglas and Abraham Lincoln?
Well, this is a curious and interesting question because Lincoln's religious beliefs are very complicated. Lincoln himself was a very private man. He did not like to talk publicly about himself, about his inner life. He did not, in fact, even really like to talk very much about his growing up and his background. And always, because a good politician that he was, he had to be concerned that someone was asking questions about those subjects with a view towards using the answers as a stick to beat him with. On one occasion, one neighbor of his, a Baptist minister named Noyes Minor, pressed him on what it had been like for Lincoln growing up. And Lincoln kept evading and evading. And finally, Lincoln turned on him and said, "You know, I have seen a great deal of the backside of the world." And he wouldn't talk about it anymore. People who tried to plumb the depths of what Lincoln thought on the subject of religion got something of the same response. One of Lincoln's longtime friends, the judge of the 8th Judicial Circuit in Illinois, David Davis, whom he appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court when he became president, responded to a question one time about Lincoln's religion by saying, "I don't know anything about Lincoln's religion, and what's more, neither does anyone else, because Lincoln would never talk about the subject." Well, Lincoln actually does talk sometimes about religion, but even then, it's not terribly personal, and it's not always quite as revealing as people might think. Now, you mentioned the campaign in which he had to respond to accusations that he wasn't a member of a church. That occurred in the 1840s when he was running for Congress. The man he was running against happened to be a circuit-riding Methodist preacher who thought he could make some hay out of embarrassing Lincoln this way. Well, Lincoln took this seriously enough that he had a broadside printed up and distributed throughout the 7th Congressional District, saying in a somewhat evasive way, "Oh, it's true, I'm not a member of any denomination, but I have never spoken disrespectfully of any Christian church. I've never spoken disrespectfully of the Bible. I, in fact, couldn't support someone who really did things like that." In other words, he said a great deal about what he didn't think, but wouldn't come right out and say what it was he did think, which was probably good politics because it got him elected to Congress.
Hmm. Didn't he, though, after their son Eddie died, didn't Mary and Abraham buy a pew in the Presbyterian Church in Springfield?
Well, the Lincolns do rent a pew in the Presbyterian Church, but Lincoln is not what you would call a diligent attender. Hmm. Mary is, but her husband, it was remarked by another minister in Springfield when he was interviewed in 1860, that Lincoln generally spends the Sabbath day down at the railroad station reading newspapers and telling jokes to the workmen. So even then, there was this sense that it's not all that it might look like on the surface. And yet, I have to say this, the pressure and the stress and the carnage of the Civil War weigh heavily on Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And the turns of events that he has to encounter during the Civil War are so unexpected, so far removed from what he might have planned for or hoped or anticipated, that he really begins to look at events and wonder, is another hand at work here? Hmm. He writes this interesting memorandum, which his secretaries dated to the fall of 1862, in which he wonders out loud, is God really directing events? None of these events in the war have turned out any way that anyone had planned for. It looks like God has a different purpose than either North or South had planned in this, and I am just about persuaded that this is the case. When finally, in his second inaugural, just 6 weeks before his death, he has again to deal with this question of why has this terrible war happened, the answers he comes up with really are not political or economic answers. They're really answers out of a theology textbook. God has willed this war, and he has willed it as a judgment on the American people, because we are all guilty. We are all people who have had our hands imbrued with this terrible crime of slavery, and that is why this war has been brought upon us. Now, anyone who wants to accuse God and say, "Hey, that's not fair, the North was on the side of truth and right, and they were trying to free the slaves," Lincoln's response would simply be, judge not that ye be not judged.
Right.
Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And he leaves it at that. That's an extraordinary statement for a man who is, after all, a lawyer, a politician, and a president. And it shows a depth of thinking and
struggling
and wrestling.
Yes.
With these questions that you don't often get from politicians.
Right. That depth of thinking is so omnipresent in his life in so many ways. When we took some listeners to Gettysburg in D.C., Gettysburg where you are now, and I will never forget standing in the spot where he gave the Gettysburg Address and the wonderful guide whose grandfather had been at the Battle of Gettysburg describing what the scene must have been like for Abraham Lincoln, you know, with the hospital and people having lost legs and arms, and so you could smell that in the air as he was giving the address. And
oh, yes.
It was just, it just stops you. All you can do is sort of weep and imagine the deep thinking that went on in his mind and the enormity of what he was speaking to. It was so big, wasn't it?
It was, because he, in the Gettysburg Address, really presents us with the biggest question that we could possibly ask about our democracy, and that is this democracy going to blow its brains out? Is what's happening in the Civil War an indication that democracies are fundamentally flawed?
Mm-hmm.
That if you say that the ordinary people of a country are the ones who are capable of ruling it, and they come to an obstacle in the road that they can't resolve, and they start tearing at each other, doesn't that prove that democracy is a farce, that democracy doesn't work? And Lincoln looks around that cemetery, looks at those semicircular rows of the newly buried dead, and he says, if you want proof that there is something worth believing in democracy, look around you. Look at those who have given the last full measure of devotion. We're not dedicating a cemetery here. They've done that already. It's we who have to dedicate ourselves to that same cause that they have thus far so nobly advanced. And that's why he calls on us to dedicate our... And you know, it's curious. It's almost couched in terms of a religious revival. He says, we want to have a new birth of freedom, so the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And that's the fundamental question that's posed by this war. Can ordinary people govern themselves? That's the essence of democracy. And he believes they can, and that the proof of it is right there at that cemetery in Gettysburg.
Mm. Gives me chills just to hear you say that. All right, let's go to, thanks, Frank, for your call. Rich in Rhinelander. Rich was on that trip. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Kathleen, life is good in retirement, and I can tell you why, because I've been reading the James Oakes review of the Sidney Blumenthal books on Lincoln in the New York Review of Books, and now this program.
All right. So, plus, you've got dogs, Rich.
There's going to be richness in retirement, let me tell you.
Yeah, thanks.
My question is, by about 1850, 1860, there were an awful lot of foreign-born Americans, and I see parallels to today. I mean, the Irish potato famine was 1845 to 49, I think. And my question for the professor is, how did Lincoln feel about immigration and about the kind of evolving nature of American society? And if he has any comments on any parallels he sees to where we are today with Donald J. Trump as our president, I'd be really, really interested. But the Irish are about 10% of the American population, and were very prominent immigrants. They were foreign-born workers at the lead up to the Civil War, and certainly were very involved in the Civil War.
Absolutely. Certainly the Iron Brigade in at Gettysburg, too.
Well, there's an interesting way of looking at this, because Lincoln himself had to deal with people in his own time who were very hostile to immigrants, immigrant culture. They were called the Know-Nothings. Mm-hmm. Their official name was the American Party, but you actually had an organized political party, fairly short-lived, but organized, that was dedicated to barring immigrants, per se. Lincoln himself, however, said, how can someone who is opposed to the oppression of Negroes favor the oppression of Irish, German, or Catholics? He said, when we get to that point, then I would rather leave the country and move to Russia, where the Tsar who rules, and there I can take oppression unalloyed with the base nature of hypocrisy. For him, it was a matter of consistency. At one point in 1858, during the campaign against Stephen A. Douglas, he says, you know, one half of our population, at least, was born someplace else, in, you know, Ireland or Scandinavia or other places in Europe. And he said, when people are invited to read the law books and the textbooks, it's just word salad to them. But when they look into the Declaration of Independence and they read those words, that all men are created equal, then, he said, they feel that they are bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh of those old men that made the revolution. For Lincoln, the American democracy was built on something really remarkable, a proposition. Now, this was so different from any other previous nation, because other nations were built on race or ethnicity or language or culture. But the United States of America was dedicated to a proposition. And to that, any person yearning to breathe free could give their assent and be an American fully as much as any other American. He liked to tell jokes during the Civil War about immigrants. Sometimes we might wonder if he was being a violator of political correctness, as it was in the 1860s. But right. He did like to tell ethnic jokes.
Yeah.
And one joke he told, and these were gentle jokes, mind you, one joke he told was about an Irish soldier who was standing up to enlist, and he was asked by the enlisting officer what his native state was. And the Irishman responded, well, I was born in Ireland, but Indiana is me native state. A joke, but for Lincoln, also a parable.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, this man might have been born in Ireland, but by embracing that proposition, he had, in fact, made Indiana and all the United States his native states. And this was, of course, a man who was then going to go and fight to defend that. Lincoln once said to a delegation of soldiers outside the White House, why are we fighting this war? We're fighting this war, he said, so that your sons can come and live in this big White House the same way that my father's child has. And for him, it was the openness of American society that he thought was the most important and the thing most to be celebrated. If we fall away from celebrating that, then I think we fall away in some important measure from Abraham Lincoln's vision of America.
Thank you, Rich, so much for your call. Glad you were on those journeys with Steve, and glad I met your doggies. Good luck with your new doggies. Let's talk about Gettysburg. It's where you are right now, and you've written a book about Gettysburg. You have written that the battle for Gettysburg was a human and environmental catastrophe, and for the United States, and this is so significant, almost the beginning of the end of its existence. How did the Confederacy lose?
Well, the Confederacy loses partly because of extremely bad decisions that are made by its leadership, but it also loses because of Lincoln's determination not to wear out. The single most important person who is to be identified as an enemy of the Confederate success is Abraham Lincoln, because he will not give up. He will not accept defeat. He will appoint new generals. He will recruit new armies. He will send as much force as he can muster against the Confederacy until the Confederacy is worn down to the nubs. Some Confederate leaders understood this. They realized that the Confederacy could not go a long-distance bout. This is why Robert E. Lee, who is one of these perceptive people, decides to invade Pennsylvania in 1863. Because he realizes he can't shake off this bulldog, Lincoln. that the only way to do it is to get someone to remove him. And the only way to get him removed is to win some kind of victory on northern soil that will so discourage northern public opinion and northern politics that they will compel Lincoln politically to let go. In the longest view of things, the man who is the greatest enemy of the Confederacy is Lincoln, simply because he will not take no for an answer. And Gettysburg is the gamble that the Confederacy takes. It's the dice that Robert E. Lee throws to try to make him shake loose. They lose. They lose in large measure, I think, because the Northern soldiers fighting on Northern soil fought harder than they had ever fought before. The Confederates made mistakes that they could not retrieve. And in the end, they are defeated. And although it's not the end of the war, I mean, the war goes on for another 22 long, bloody, hard, broken months. Nevertheless, the sun never shines on the South again after Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Judith in Muskego next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I'd like to share the fact that the Beloit newspaper carried an article to substantiate this, that Lincoln stopped at Archie Cranston's farm, which was founded in 1856, on the way to Janesville to water his horse, and I believe Archie's wife offered him coffee. And his great-granddaughter Norma passed away Saturday at the age of 99.
Which reminds us that a lot of this has not happened all that long ago, has it?
Right. No, it isn't that long ago. It is just not that long ago. Thank you, Judith, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Abraham Lincoln this hour of the program, and our guest is an esteemed historian who's written many, many books about our 16th president. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We want to talk also about the Emancipation Proclamation. Our guest wrote a book about this because he bemoaned the fact that there was a lack of literature on the Emancipation Proclamation and that the recovery of the Union, not emancipation, was foremost in Lincoln's mind during the Civil War. So we'll talk about the attention he paid to that as we continue here on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Alan Carl Gelzo. He is Henry Luce, the third professor of the Civil War era at Gettysburg College, and he is the author of all kinds of books about Abraham Lincoln, including Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, The End of Slavery in America, Lincoln and Douglas, The Debates That Defined America, Abraham Lincoln as a Man of Ideas, and Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. I've heard you talk about the Emancipation Proclamation and decided to write a book about it because you thought that not enough attention had been paid to it. Why not? What did you add?
Well, I think a lot of people shied away from writing about the Emancipation Proclamation because it's simply not a particularly exciting document of Lincoln's to write about. If you read the Gettysburg Address, you're reading golden eloquence. I mean, 272 words, every one of them worth memorizing.
Mm-hmm.
The second inaugural, gorgeous. It's a
yes.
Cross between a benediction and a sermon.
Yes.
But you read the Emancipation Proclamation and, my goodness, it starts off with, whereas. and it reads in a very labored, legal way, as no one less, believe it or not, Karl Marx once commented, it reads like a summons sent by an attorney to a county court clerk. And let's be frank, it is a very legalistic sounding document. You wonder, does this come from the same pen that wrote the Gettysburg Address? So for that reason, people back off from it. It just doesn't send that kind of Chris Matthews tingle down the leg. and what's more, it has limitations. All right, this is an Emancipation Proclamation, right? This is supposed to be about emancipating? Yeah, right up until you get to the part where it starts making exceptions. Emancipation, except in these counties in Virginia, and, you know, these areas in Louisiana. You get a ways into it, and you wonder just exactly who was being emancipated by this document. I think that's a reaction that comes from people who forget two things. One, that Lincoln is a lawyer, and B, that this is a legal document. I mean, the Gettysburg Address is beautiful. First inaugural, second inaugural, marvelous. But you can't take them into a court of law. I mean, when the state trooper pulls you over on the interstate and wants to give you a ticket, reciting the Gettysburg Address to him is not going to improve matters. But
I'm sorry.
The Emancipation Proclamation is different. It literally is a legal document, and it has some heavy lifting to do. And that heavy lifting really is in which he says that those who are the subjects of this proclamation, henceforth and forever, are free. Now, people look at the limitations and they say, well, yeah, but. Well, let me tell you about the limitations, because every legal document has its limitations. Always when Lincoln addresses the question of slavery, he has to balance his desire, which he said in August of 1862, was that everyone should be free, with the legal and constitutional realities. And the principal constitutional reality is that presidents don't have the right to do kinds of things like that. Presidents are only presidents. They're not monarchs. They're not dictators. They're not aristocrats. They're just presidents. They're the chief executive. They're the head of the executive branch. They've got to obey the law just as much as anybody else. And if Lincoln had jumped ahead and the day after Fort Sumter had gotten up and said, I think I'll free all the slaves. You know, scratch, scratch, scratch. Mm-hmm. Hey, you're free. Let me tell you the next thing that would have happened. Every slave owner still within the Union, and that would have included four states, the border states, every slave owner still within the Union would have paraded down to the local federal courthouse and demanded an injunction. The injunction would have been given. The whole thing would have gone into the federal courts. It would have been appealed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And who is sitting as Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court? Roger B. Taney, the author of the infamous Dred Scott decision. Take three quick guesses how he is going to decide on a case involving Lincoln emancipating people. So what Lincoln has to do with the Emancipation Proclamation is to write a legal document that will walk around the federal courts. He issues it as a War Powers Proclamation by his authority as Commander-in-Chief. It's not because he's trying to dodge the justice of the document or its gesture. What he's trying to do is to avoid a court challenge that is going to give Chief Justice Taney an attempt to put a spike right through the heart of abolition. He writes it so carefully. He writes it so that it is proof against court challenge. And you know something? It works.
Remarkable. And the response, the reaction to the document was?
On the part of Northerners, it was rejoicing. Mm-hmm. On the part of the Confederacy, it was howls of condemnation and the threat that any black soldiers captured in uniform would be returned to slavery and their officers executed on the grounds that they had encouraged slave rebellions.
Let's go to more phone calls for you. Jim in Fairchild. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just have a brief comment about what I've understood about the Emancipation Proclamation as it's been interpreted recently. Is there or is there not clauses in there that permit modern-day slavery in the events of or in the situation of incarceration? So someone in jail, and I'll take my answer off the air.
There's nothing that talks about incarceration in the Emancipation Proclamation, but it does in the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, except when you're talking about involuntary servitude that is part of punishment levied out for crimes. So there's nothing in the Emancipation Proclamation that refers to that. And I think it's a serious misconstruction of the 13th Amendment to regard incarceration as a form of slavery. No, incarceration is incarceration. Slavery is slavery. People who are trying to mix the two are trying, in my opinion, to play a very deep political game, but it's a game. a game played with words and not with real concepts. Lincoln is not trying to make exceptions or provisions. He's not trying to create a system of slave labor that can be legalized. What is true, however, is that the Emancipation Proclamation frees slaves. It doesn't abolish slavery as a legal institution. And it doesn't do that because, again, as president, he doesn't have the authority to do that. Slave statutes, the statutes, the laws that legalized slavery, were state enactments. He has no authority to reach over the wall between state and federal authority and change state laws. The only thing that can do that is an amendment to the Constitution. When he issues the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, he does it because there is no real prospect of an amendment to the Constitution abolishing the legal institution of slavery. Now, things will change over the next 2 years, and by January of 1865, that is what he gets, and he is delighted at the prospect of signing it. He says, the Emancipation Proclamation was a first step. The 13th Amendment is the king's cure for the evil. That gets rid of the entire possibility of slavery in the United States. Mm. So the line that we walk from the Emancipation Proclamation to the 13th Amendment is a line of increasing political possibilities. It's one that Lincoln follows strenuously and which he rejoices in. But it is not one which deals with incarceration or commits what I think is the folly of trying to fuzz the line between slavery and incarceration. If you want to know where that line really lay, all you would have had to have done was to have asked any African-American slave in 1865.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Time for one more call, probably. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Wow, well, thank you so very much. When your guest mentioned that people oppose slavery based on the idea of economic competition, I started thinking about Latin America, and I got out this book about it, and I discovered that in maybe the 1850s, there was this American-backed expedition into Central America to take over some land there, financed by bankers and supported by the U.S. government, and headed by this guy, William Walker. And I just wonder what you can tell us about Lincoln's attitudes toward Central America or Latin America.
And also the Mexican War, his attitudes toward that, too.
Right. These were called filibustering expeditions. They were privately financed, funded, and recruited, largely by Southerners, with a view towards overthrowing Central American governments and installing pro-slavery regimes there, perhaps with a view, once those regimes were established, to having them annexed to the United States. Slavery was an expansionist, even an imperialistic way of thinking, because slave owners in the South were not content just to have slavery in the states where it was legalized. They wanted it to expand into the Western territories. That's really the flashpoint of controversy in the American Civil War. But they also wanted it to expand into the West Indies, the Caribbean, into Central America. They would have been happy to have seen states in Central America absorbed into a slave empire. And they worked very hard at doing this. William Walker, in that respect, is simply doing on a private basis what pro-slavery thinkers had been agitating for all along, and which they hope would then be receiving a public approval by annexation to the United States. Lincoln is utterly opposed to this. Lincoln does not believe that it is the purpose of the United States to do regime change, to meddle in other countries' affairs. In 1848, the Hungarian freedom fighter, Louis Kossuth, tours the United States trying to raise money, trying to recruit Americans to go fight against the Austrian Empire. It was a noble cause in many ways. But Lincoln, even though he is willing to applaud Louis Kossuth, also pulls back from the idea that Americans should involve themselves in the domestic affairs of other nations. Hmm. He was even more adamantly opposed to the idea of private expeditions that would try to overthrow Central American governments for the purpose of annexing them to the United States. In fact, even during the Mexican War, he takes his political life in his own hands to denounce President Polk Mm-hmm. And the program of annexation that Polk was going to inflict on the Mexican Republic as a result of the Mexican War.
And on that note, we have to say so long. Sarah, thanks for the call. Aren't you glad you read that comic book?
It was all there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was all there. Thank you so much for the body of work and for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Professor Alan Carl Gelzo, he's a professor of Civil War era at Gettysburg College. Tomorrow during this hour, our special guest Ron Suskind will join us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of several books, including Life Animated, about his son's autism, which was adapted into a documentary film. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing the hour, Colleen Leahy on air production.